a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Luth, I think, Jason, this isn't the first time that you've been to this particular dance. It's good to see that you're bringing the crew back with you. Happy to have you here, and we'd invite you as we get into this process to ask some questions as well. Let me also just start out by making an announcement that we've been looking forward to making for a number of months now, and that is that the Board of Economic Development has unanimously approved a Northern Beef Packers Ready Fund loan application in the amount of $5 million. The project is estimated to be in excess of $120 million and is expected to create 566 jobs at this beef processing plant in Aberdeen by the year 2012. The plant is projected to process 1,500 head of cattle per day, or 7,500 head per week, or, if you're looking at it on an annual basis, 390,000 head a year. And that's on just a single shift. If it gets good and we can continue, they can add shifts. The Ready Fund loan is what we call takeout financing, which will not be funded until after construction. There are significant financing approvals from conventional lenders and the community yet to be obtained, and construction contracts are yet to be negotiated. But the owners are very optimistic that the project is on track and will get contractors working again, get people employed, and provide a market for producers and South Dakota certified beef. The state of South Dakota's Department of Tourism and State Development, and I see Rich Bende is here with us today, and the State Department of Agriculture have been committed to the project since its inception. With the new ownership and the renewed focus from Maverick Spade Management and Advisory Services working with the state and the community, we hope to bring this very much needed project to completion. Secretaries Richard Benda and Bill Even, who is our Secretary of Ag, have worked tirelessly to get the project moving since Maverick Spade was enlisted. I want to publicly thank them for their hard work over the last number of months. Northern Beef Packers hopes to have project financing secured within the next 3 months. With construction financing in place, the plant could be operational as early as the fall or winter of this year. That's great news for South Dakota producers. It means they have one more opportunity to process livestock to process beef in South Dakota. This will be the first large processing facility for beef within our state. So we're very, very happy to have the great news. As we say, not everything is completed yet, but it was an opportunity for us to share that the Board of Economic Development has unanimously approved the request for funding from the Northern Beef Packers, and now it's a matter of them following through and getting all of their work done that is required, the approvals at the local level, the other financing and so forth, and then finally our participation is one of the last items that kind of puts the frosting on the cake. But we're very, very pleased to have this move forward, and it's a major step, not only for the community of Aberdeen, but for, as I say, the producers in South Dakota, because now South Dakota certified beef can start to really move. Not only can we produce certified livestock that are age and source verified, but now we have a processing plant that will be certified for producing the certified beef for export as well as for our domestic markets. With that, we'll open it up for questions. And Rich, if you want to join us up here in case anybody has any questions for Secretary Benda on that particular project as well.
Governor, I understand you were one of the governors met with the president yesterday to discuss energy issues. What did you take away from that? What was your impression? What did you like or dislike?
The president invited 11 governors to come in for a meeting. I suspect we spent, I think, a little over an hour total. The vice president was there. A number of members of his cabinet were there as well. They asked each of us what we had thought in terms of energy development and what the challenges were from our prospective states. It was a very frank discussion, and we have. I will tell you that we have the governors individually each expressed their appreciation for the opportunity for input and for feedback. And I think the feedback from the president and the vice president and their cabinet members was also appreciated. I had shared that I thought, first of all, with regard to ethanol, it was very important that the new RFS2, the new Renewable Fuel Standards 2, include language that would allow us to move to the E15 rather than E10. I also was concerned and expressed in a discussion with Secretary Vilsack, Secretary of Ag Tom Vilsack, who was the governor of Iowa and who has been a good supporter of ethanol. I expressed to him my concern that the indirect land use provisions of the RFS2 might impact ethanol production in the Midwest. And he has assured me that he has worked very, very hard so that the provisions concerning indirect land use should not impact ethanol producers in the upper Midwest. The indirect land use provisions are still in the bill, but he believes that because of provisions about the amount being produced and so forth, he believes that it should not impact our ethanol producers, which is great news. But we did share that discussion with the president, and we also asked that they continue to support and ask the EPA to expedite their decision on moving from E10 to E15. I came away with the impression that they were moving in that direction and that they were simply trying to move through the administrative processes as quickly as possible. I also shared that wind development in South Dakota started at about 8 megawatts back in 2002, and since that time we're up to over 320 megawatts, but we have a huge capacity for more wind generation, particularly in areas where we can get the power out on existing lines or on new lines as they become available. But until we get a way to get that energy, that proposed energy to the markets, it's not going to happen. I suggested that we look at the large lines that have been discussed moving all the way into the eastern part of the Midwest, into Chicago primarily, and that we're supportive of those lines, the larger lines, the DC lines. But in the meantime, while we're discussing those huge lines, it would sure be worthwhile to use the existing lines to maybe up to more capacity. And that I asked if they would consider asking the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Western Area Power Administration to coordinate efforts to allow for wind-generated electricity to be put on those existing lines, and then to upgrade those lines as well. So rather than simply flushing fresh, clean water out of the Missouri River dams, we use wind power whenever possible, put them on those lines that are already in place, and perhaps not flush as much of our clean water down during times of drought. And there was an interest. There were folks making notes, and whether or not it comes to fruition or if we get a coordinated effort. But right now, the Corps of Engineers does not see it as part of their job description nor part of what Congress has directed them to do. Western Area Power Administration has not seen it in the past as part of their mission, and the Bureau of Reclamation has not seen it as part of their mission. And it looks to me like this is something that could be very helpful to producers of wind energy in South Dakota, both North and South Dakota. We also discussed, and I expressed concern about a carbon tax or a cap and trade program, my concern being that we have to have appropriate technology. And that if we want businesses to capture carbon and sequester it, that we've got to have a technology that is usable. And that if the federal government truly wants to see strides made in capturing carbon and reducing the carbon footprint in the atmosphere, we have to have technologies that businesses will utilize. I told them that I thought one place that they could start is you have a brand new refinery, the first one since 1976 that's been permitted, and our permitting process on the air quality side is complete with the Hyperion project, and that it was designed so that when the time is right and the plans can be put in place, we can capture the carbon from their power plant. But there has to be a reason for doing it. There has to be some assistance from the federal government. And I suggested that they might look at that particular power or that particular refinery as one alternative for a plant in the future that they might want to try to work with to show evidence that you can actually capture carbon and sequester it or put it to another use in which it doesn't go into the atmosphere. And we're the only ones that have got a new refinery online. And it's the first one since 1976. So I think we'd be in a pretty good shape if they consider that those types of facilities do put carbon dioxide in the air. And if they want a new one to work with the best available technologies, this would be a great step. And then finally, I suggested that with nuclear, we don't have nuclear facilities in South Dakota, but that if they're going to be looking at providing incentives for nuclear plants, we know that the existing facilities across the United States where there are existing plants at locations where they have trained workers, what they're going to do first before they add any new plants is to add additional capacity for more nuclear generation at existing brownfield sites, places where there's already a nuclear plant. So if you've got one that's producing 1,000 megawatts, the first step will be to try to set up another reactor right next to it to produce another 1,000 megawatts. And because they've already got transmission lines, they can upgrade from those locations. I suggested that while that'll happen, someone really needs to take a hard look at the need for greenfield sites. And so if there is in their discussions in terms of incentives for nuclear power plants to be built, let's not look at only brownfield sites. Let's look at greenfield sites, new site locations where nuclear energy would be established or nuclear power plants could be established. And I think South Dakota is as good a place as any place to establish a greenfield site. And I suggested, though, that their plans for subsidizing or providing incentives include language that allows for greenfield sites as well as the brownfield or existing sites to exist. And then finally, just in terms of a suggestion, I truly believe that the way that we move energy forward and new energy sources forward is not by making existing energy sources more expensive, but rather by making alternative new energy sources, the renewables, more competitive. And if we can do that, making wind energy more competitive, new technology, making nuclear more competitive, making clean coal technologies more competitive, that's the direction that people will go. But simply adding a tax, is not the right way to go, because a lot of the major businesses in the United States, you get so far along and pretty soon they simply leave your borders. They head overseas to where these types of regulatory aspects haven't been developed yet. So that was our discussion, my point of view on it, and as we listened, the other governors had differing points of view. Some of them are from coal generating states and they're very concerned about carbon, about cap and trade. One of the governors suggested strongly that they look, if they're going to go someplace for new technologies, that they put a tax on carbon, a minimal tax on carbon, but separate it out from the federal government keeping the money and putting it all directly back into creating new technologies, clearly benefiting the industry. But a lot of discussion along the lines of folks just saying, please, whatever you do in this time of a national recession, don't slow down our economy by making the cost of energy greater. I thought it was a very good down-to-earth discussion, and I think the president was very gracious to all of us, had good feedback, and it's one of those opportunities that you don't get very often, and CMO certainly want to take advantage of it when you do, to share your thoughts with the president and the vice president.
Governor, if you could just elaborate a little more on the international indirect land use. You think the Secretary Bill Sachs and the administration were they don't want this to impede on ethanol. I know Senator Thune and some others have been really sounding the alarm about this provision. Do you think they're right to be so concerned, or do you trust the administration here?
I asked Secretary Vilsack yesterday about the concerns, and he said, look, the original RFS proposal did have some rather tough things in it. But he said, look, he told me just before the meeting with the president, he believed that the way that other language has been written in, that the definitions would allow ethanol produced in the Midwestern part of the United States to not be subject to the indirect land use provisions of the RFS2. The indirect land use provisions are where they try to hold accountable Midwestern companies for the activities going on in South America, where if they clear a rainforest and they burn a forest off, that creates carbon for the atmosphere. And they wanted to hold in the earlier versions, and in this one to some extent, they wanted to hold our South Dakota producers responsible for that type of activity on another continent, indirect land use. And that was the concern that our producers have had. the Secretary has told me that he believes the complete language within the bill allows our producers not to be affected by this particular provision. I have not had the opportunity to review it. I'll let the folks that are actively engaged in the industry come back and look at it and tell me whether or not they agree with the Secretary's assessment, but I don't have any reason to believe that Secretary Vilsack would do anything except try to improve the opportunities for ethanol in the Midwest. He was the governor of Iowa. He understands ethanol. He's been a supporter of ethanol in the past, and I believe that it is his intention in working as a member of the cabinet to assist in producing more ethanol in the upper Midwest. And I'll take him at his word until someone shows me different, but naturally it's a matter of folks looking at it, and then they can come back in and tell me if some more work's got to be done on it.
Governor, what do you think of the chances of building a new nuclear power plant in the state?
Very remote. I believe that the nuclear industry, and we've talked to them for the last 7 years now, they have indicated that the first locations where they will go is where they have a trained workforce, where they have existing facilities, where they have existing distribution systems, and that means they'll go back into their brownfield sites or the existing location sites first. There's a series of priorities that they have to have in order to put in a nuclear facility. They've got to have a good rail system going in and out in order to haul heavy pieces of equipment, machinery, and parts. They have to have a very adequate water supply. And there's got to be a reason for siting it next to or close to where there's either a very good distribution system for power or a market for the power so that they don't have to transmit it over an extended distance. But throughout this discussion, the thing remains that if we want to move from coal in some fashion, nuclear may very well provide another alternative for us. And in the future, if some of our companies that produce power look at transitioning from a coal-fired facility over the next generation to a nuclear-fired facility, and I don't want to have those particular companies be left short because they're not on a brownfield site. So it's a matter of establishing that if they're going to do incentives, let's make sure that greenfield sites can compete with the other sites, the existing sites, for any incentives that might be made available for conversion of those units.
Governor?
Yes.
Tony Mangan in KCCR.
Yes, Tony.
On another issue, on a legislative issue, and I know you don't talk about pending legislation, but have you given any thought to your brother's legislation about 19 to 21 year olds drinking in controlled establishments?
Tony, I have not seen the legislation. Now, I did read a news article this morning before coming in about what some of the provisions in the original bill would be. I understand that the attempt is to put together a plan in which 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds could consume alcoholic beverages, probably limited to beer, I'm assuming, on premises in private clubs. There's a belief that this would be a suitable approach that would not stop us from receiving federal funds. I'm very concerned that the state not lose the federal funds. I don't think it was right that the federal government put that provision in place to begin with, but they did, and we have to live with it. I'm open to listen to the arguments that this could be accomplished, and if the legislature does come up with a plan that there is a good confidence level in that they could get around the federal guidelines that are in place, then I'll take a good hard look at the bill. Philosophically, when I was growing up, students were allowed to drink beer at the age of 18. Young people age 18, 19, and 20 could drink beer. I think it's better to limit it to 19 and 20. It's an age-specific type of a limitation. It changes based upon an arbitrary age of 21 right now. I don't think there's anything wrong with discussing an earlier age. I am concerned about some other things that it would bring up. I'm not sure with our DUI laws how they would be impacted because there's a lower limit for young people in terms of where DUI is established. That would have to be a part of the, of any discussion. But just in terms of if me personally, if someone asked me if the federal government repealed all of their big government approaches to the regulation of liquor and said we're going to let the states do it, I would have no objection to having it be at the age of 19. Because I think young people are doing it now. I think they're engaging in it. It's just in a clandestine type of approach. They're either in vehicles or they're at private parties. It's happening. And the folks that get caught get it on their record. I see it on a regular basis in requests for pardons for young people that have had the run-in with the law. I know that some of the law enforcement folks have expressed concerns just on the premise of more people consuming alcohol at a younger age. But the reality is that whether it's at 19 or 20 or 21, there is a learning time period. And so if we made the law 25, we'd still be having the issue of 24-year-olds drinking beer. So the reality is it's an age-specific thing, and no particular age is the magic age, except that it has to be kept out of high schools. It has to be kept out of high schools. So other than that, I'm open to it. But I have not seen the bill, and I will withhold my judgment on this particular legislation until I actually get a chance to look at it, should it pass the legislature.
Now, he has said, Governor, he told me that he has not talked to you about it. Given the relationship brother to brother, are you staying out of this one a little bit just because it's a brother-brother thing?
I'm not staying out of it because it's my brother doing it. I'm basically just looking at it as it's a policy decision for the legislature to look at. It's not our proposal. And normally we have a guideline here that unless it impacts our state government, unless it impacts our budget, and in this case, as I've said, I put a qualifier on it. If it impacts our federal highway funding, then we get involved. If they can find a way to do this without impacting our federal highway funding, then this is a public policy discussion that goes on, and it'll be a healthy debate. And so it's if it would have been another legislator besides my brother, I'd still probably take the same position. Just it cannot impact federal funding. That's critical.
Governor, we're scheduled to get some more snow today over the next few days, and we've had a lot already, and the National Weather Service was saying last week that they expect March to be a really wet month. At what point do you start being concerned about flooding in the spring and taking efforts to prepare for that?
We've started already. We're aware that the possibilities of spring flooding are probably greater this year than in some of the previous years. The Department of Public Safety has already started putting together the plans. We'll have, as a matter of fact, this with the legislature leaving tomorrow and Monday, we're actually already scheduling meetings with my office on the issue of flooding and the possibilities. So we'll get reports from the National Weather Services as updated as they can be, along with what our responses will be, where the greatest threats of flooding are, and what the impacts are going to be. So we've started already about 2 weeks ago with some of the preliminary discussions about how we're going to respond. What else? We've got some students in here from Washington High School, and I believe some honor students in here involved in the press as well. And if any of you have questions or would like to talk about anything, we'd be happy to field questions from any of you.
Governor, I have one.
Yes. Tell us who you are, okay?
I'm Kathy Bartlett. I'm a senior this year.
Okay. Are you the editor by any chance?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So there was a bill in the House Education Committee yesterday that would allow students to substitute career technical education credits for foreign language part of credits and still be eligible to receive the South Dakota Opportunity Scholarship. Do you think that this is a good idea considering like the two new high schools opening in fall that are project-based technical high schools next year?
I would not be opposed to it, but I would leave it up to literally the legislature and to our Board of Education to make a decision basically as to what would be appropriate. I can tell you that the Board of Regents are going to take a good hard look at any changes in a number of those guidelines. A part of it is to make very certain that anybody coming into our university structure, if we can provide incentives for them so that they've got a really good chance at making it through in 4 years or 4.5 years, one of the things we're finding is that, you know, we've got one of the highest percentages of young people that actually go on from high school into the university system, but we lose them once they get into the system. Part of it is because when they get in, it's a little bit different than what they expected coming out of high school. And so we want them prepared. The remedial classes are still going on in college to try to bring them up to speed in some areas. So there's an expectation at the Regento level for our students coming in prepared differently, perhaps, than what some of them are. You have to be able to coordinate what the expectations are and provide incentives so that a young person has the best opportunity that we can give them to pick up an appropriate degree. Whether a particular area of technical expertise should be appropriate as opposed to a foreign language, I'll leave that up to the folks that are in the business full-time of training young people and making sure they've got an adequate study. Is it worthwhile for debate? Absolutely. And the reason? More and more we're putting emphasis on research and technology. But that means that the courses that we're expecting students to take should clearly be on as close to the cutting edge as we can get for high school courses in research and technology. Then I think it's a fair item for debate. The question is should you have a high school a biology class, or should you have a high school mathematics class? Both are necessary. Both are important. Can you substitute one for the other? And those types of issues, I think they're very healthy to debate. I don't have a prejudice one way or the other on it. I think it's a very good discussion to have.
Do you think that the new technical high schools will better prepare students to enter the workforce in South Dakota and keep them in South Dakota?
I'm excited about what they offer us, because what we're really saying is people that understand technology, understand computers, understand communications. And we've tried to do this with the one-to-one classroom connections, the laptop connections for smaller schools. Some of the larger schools probably had more resources to be able to do these kinds of projects. A lot of the smaller schools didn't. That's the reason why we pushed hard to have the laptop connections program in place to provide incentives for small schools to get computers so that everybody could kind of get in and get a sense of how critical they are in day-to-day activity. For a lot of years, if your mom and dad had the money, you probably had a computer. But for young people that just, were family struggling, not to have a computer put them way behind in terms of education. These new career centers or these new technical schools, their emphasis is on not the old type of technology, but the new kinds of technology. And I'm optimistic that they're going to be a step in the right direction. And I think we'll find other schools looking at the successes that they have and trying to incorporate them more in the other schools as well. So I'm optimistic about it. I think it was a very good idea.
Governor.
Yes.
I'm Austin Ashlack from a junior this year. Aside from the technical academy that are being built, what is the state doing to keep high school students in the state after graduation? Without the budget requirements hampering your efforts?
The biggest challenge that we've had in South Dakota since I've been governor, and I believe since before I was governor, was keeping young people in our state. It's the reason why we created the 2010 Economic Development Initiative. The idea was to provide, under goal number 3, for South Dakota to become a recognized leader in areas of research and technology. But we also wanted young people to have multiple avenues to pursue their future employment in lots of different areas. Our universities are at record enrollment. Our technical schools are at record enrollment, even though we have about 10 to 15,000 fewer kids graduating from high schools than what there was in the year 2000. So we're getting a higher percentage of our young people to stay here in South Dakota through college. And then, as the need becomes even more important, we're providing them with new PhD programs and new master's programs. Because if we don't have them here, those young people are going to go someplace else and get them. They're bright enough to where they can go any place. So what we focused on was, how do we keep young people here so they grow their roots here? So that this is where they meet their spouse. This is where they start their family. And there were a couple things that we saw. First, we've got 23 new PhD programs, 24 master's programs. We didn't do it because we wanted to just spend the money on it. We did it because we thought it was important to have options for young people to stay here. That's been successful. Now, I don't know. I presume that you've all heard the stories that we've got out there about how we're growing state government and how all these new FTEs are floating around. And yet, if you ask the individual legislators, well, where are these FTEs at? These are teachers. These are teachers at our universities in many cases. And if they wanted to come back in and play politics, all they have to do is walk back in and say, I want you to get rid of 800 FTEs. Wouldn't touch the general fund of the state of South Dakota, but it would cut hundreds of teachers from the university systems that have been added to teach literally thousands of more students going to school here. I can't go into a university setting and say, I want you to come here, and then not provide enough teachers. And for a lot of these students that are doing master's programs, and a long way around it, but master's and PhDs, if you weren't getting paid to do a thesis, or if you weren't getting paid to do research, the chances of being able to afford to stay in college would be really difficult. I mean, it would, to borrow that kind of money and not have a job while you're at college is tough. So what we've done is we've encouraged our universities to go out and to become to get really good at looking for federal and private investment in research. And they've done just a marvelous job. And that money comes back in, but when they get it, then they've got to do the research. So if you're going to do the research, then you've got to pay somebody to do it. What better way to do it than to take an undergrad or a graduate student and to pay them some money to do the research that brought the grant in the first place? Marvelous way of keeping you here, paying you money to do it. But that means that I've got to consider you an FTE because we're paying you to do some work. So if you're a student and you're staying in South Dakota and we're paying you with a grant, is that growing government or is that growing the number of students that we're keeping in our state? That's the premise of this. And so that's, to me, is one of the most important things that we're doing to keep young people here. The second part of it is this. If we want young people to stay here, we've got to provide them with the best quality of life we can get. And that means a reason to stay here. It's the reason why we're promoting the outdoors. We promote more hunting areas. We're promoting more camping sites, more locations where you can actually find to go fishing, public access to public lands. All of those come into the point of being a location where the young people can actually enjoy their time together. The other thing, we've tried to coordinate our efforts with places like Sioux Falls, where they know that they've got to have young people coming into the city to do the work. And so if we continue to look for new jobs in healthcare, new jobs in finance and so forth, then as long as those job opportunities are there, young people will stay here if the quality of life is good. And finally, there's going to be a whole lot of young people that want to be on the cutting edge in computers. They want to be on the cutting edge in physics, mathematics. And we had no place to go with that before the Sanford Laboratory was being created. Now there's a chance for young people to actively engage with scientists from around the world who wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the Sanford Lab. That was the reason for the focus on it. Scientists come in here and they hire young people that want to work with them. Not forever, but for a period of time. And pretty soon you become a part of that group of people that are looking at new ideas and asking the new questions and talking about dark matter and about ways in which we figure out where the next sources of energy are going to come from and what the universe was really created of and how it all fits together. And this is our connection with that part of the science community. It wouldn't be there if Denny Sanford wouldn't have stepped in with a $70 million donation or if we wouldn't have had the Sanford Laboratory created. But it's only one step because all of our universities are participating in it. So regardless of if you're East River or West River, you have a chance to participate in that laboratory location. And the outreach from it, I think, is going to be immense. But those are the types of things that we're trying to focus on to keep young people in the state. A job is probably still the most important after you've got your education.
So
yeah.
Along the lines of education, a couple days ago in the Senate, they passed a measure trying to secure a grant to open a charter school for Native American students.
Yeah.
They said it might be in the Hills area. There's still a lot of planning to do, but do you know any more details about that plan?
When the Department of Education came forward, what they wanted to try to do was to put together a proposal to help Native American students that have a very difficult time moving from a reservation setting into a college atmosphere. You know, Native American students make up in excess of 9% of our total population, but they only represent 1% of our college population. And part of it is because they're kind of like me in a way. I come from a really large family. And, family is important. Well, family is important to them as well. And when all of their family is located in one particular area, and they're very close to one another, and it's a culturally, it's a very different setting. And to be expected to simply leave home and to come back out into a place where there's more wealth and a different approach to basically activities than what you find on the reservation, it's difficult for them, and it's very difficult for them to adjust. So we started out with a plan in Rapid City that's been going on for a number of years called Gear Up, in which we bring young people onto the university campus at Mines, and they're from the res. They come in, and they spend up to 6 weeks there. And what it proves to them is, number one, they can do the studies, and they can compete. And they can also leave home for a period of up to 6 weeks, and it's okay. And their parents are very supportive of them. And they come in, and we have a graduation, and the parents show up, and they're proud. But what it does is it shows them that there's one location where they can go. What we'd like to do then is to take the next step, and that is to establish a separate charter school where these young people who want to come and to be a part of it, a Native American school, but to continue on with kind of a gear-up program throughout the school year. Not doing remedial work, but taking classes and getting prepared for classes that are age-appropriate for them. That's what Gear Up does. It actually takes a junior and prepares them for senior-level courses. Well, with a charter school, we can move along that same line, and it gets them one more step to being comfortable with moving into a university setting. And so I'm very hopeful that we're funding, or that we'll have the funds to do that. I think it's a good move for those individuals that want to participate on it, or to participate in the program.
Governor, this time of year, your lieutenant governor in the news for campaign finance reports, and noted that your old campaign committee is still active. Mm-hmm. You've got about $400,000 in it. You paid out about $60,000-$70,000 for salaries and other things. Mm-hmm. Just curious, what your campaign committee is spending money on, things like that. Like, you're not running for anything that I know of.
Actually, what we do is it. It identifies within the campaign report that it has to stay active as long as there's funds in the account. And so then it wants to know, so where would you spend the dollars that are there? In some cases, we'll make donations to others that are identified or listed. But along with that, we also maintain and we continue to communicate with our supporters. We update our lists. We communicate throughout the year with them. We actually, in some cases, solicit to try to promote our ideas to be successful. But that's kind of the direction that we've done with it. If there are activities out there which are something to do with like my participation in an RGA event, Republican Governor's event, or if it's an event where I'm expected to participate but we don't use state funds to do it, we may very well use those funds to do it and pay taxes on those funds through a payroll tax.
Thank you. So the salary going to outreach type position?
Outreach in terms of working on positions that I want to see promoted and to maintain my supporter base. That's a big part of it. You'd be amazed at how valuable a political supporters list, which is updated, can be, right? But that's really what we do is we maintain it. We do our best to communicate throughout the year in different ways and continue to ask them for support in my initiatives as well. So. Anything else? Joe, did I miss anything? Any other questions on the phone? Lieutenant Governor, anything?
No, glad to be with you.
With that, thank you. Appreciate it. Drive safely going home, okay?
Thanks.
Thank you.